where over the next few weeks you'll be hearing from a number of us in the congregation about either a biblical character or a character of our choice that has a life of faith that we can learn from. And I've chosen a biblical character, one that actually shares my name, which I can't lie is the reason I wanted to look at her. And before you sort of question yourself as to where the character Rose is found in the Bible, the person I'm actually talking about is Deborah. My full name is Deborah Rose Frater, although I've been called Rose since I was born. Deborah is a family name, and the order of names was just merely a matter of phonetic taste by my parents. So that's the story there. But anyway, it is one of the reasons why I wanted to look at her, and also because we don't look enough at female characters in the Bible. Oh, I know, that's a bit naughty, isn't it? No, I mean, I didn't mean KXC. I mean, like, the church in general doesn't. Actually, not KXC's really good at it, so there you go. So anyway, it'd be helpful to begin by reading her story. So the story is found on page 245 of your pew Bibles. I've got it. on page 245, it's Judges 4 and chapters 4 and 5. But we're just going to read half of chapter 4. Chapter 4 is a factual account of the events that happened during Deborah's stories. And chapter 5 is a poem that Deborah wrote, so it's more of a poetical account. But we're just going to look at half of chapter 4. But don't worry, because if you get lost among all the long names of places and people, because I will do a little summary at the end, so don't worry too much about that. So here we go. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, now that Ehud was dead. So the Lord sold them into the hands of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. Sisera, the commander of his army, was based in Harosheth Hagoyim. Because he had 900 chariots fitted with iron and had cruelly oppressed the Israelites for 20 years, they cried to the Lord for help. Now Deborah, a prophet, the wife of Lapidoth, was leading Israel at that time. She held court under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim, and the Israelites went up to her to have their disputes decided. She sent for Barak, son of Abinoam, from Kedesh in Naphtali, and said to him, "The Lord, the God of Israel, commands you, go take with you 10,000 men of Naphtali and Zebulun, and lead them up to Mount Tabor. I will lead Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his troops, to the river Kishon, and give him into your hands." Barak said to her, "If you go with me, I will go. But if you don't go with me, I won't go." "Certainly I will go with you," said Deborah. "But because of the course you are taking, the honor will not be yours, for the Lord will deliver Sisera into the hands of a woman." So Deborah went with Barak to Kadesh. There Barak summoned Zebulun and Naphtali, and 10,000 men went up under his command. Deborah also went up with him. Now Heber the Kenite had left the other Kenites, the descendants of Hobab, Moses' brother-in-law, and pitched his tent by the great tree in Zananim near Kadesh. When they told Sisera that Barak, son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor, Sisera summoned from Harosheth Hagoyim to the river Kishon all his men and his 900 chariots fitted with iron. Then Deborah said to Barak, "Go, this is the day the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Has not the Lord gone ahead of you?" So Barak went down Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. At Barak's advance, the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots by the army, and army by the sword. And Sisera got down from his chariot and fled on foot. So, what's all that about? Basically, what we've seen is this. The Israelites were being severely oppressed by a Canaanite king and his army commander, Sisera. Deborah was a judge who was leading Israel at that time, and she called for another guy, Barak, who lived in the north of Israel, and told him to gather some troops and go down to a mountain where the Canaanite army would be waiting. And it was there that the Lord would help Israel and the Canaanite army would be delivered into their hands. Barak is understandably quite scared, so he wants Deborah to go with him. And it's here that we see the Israelites' victory. The rest of the story, which we've not read, and if you've not read it, then I would recommend that you do, because it's a bit of a chilling read, it tells of how During the battle, Sisera, the commander of the opposing army, flees to the campsite of Heber the Kenite. He is greeted by Jael, who is Heber's wife, and Jael, he thinks that she's an ally, and she lures him into her tent, and while he's asleep, she kills him with a tent peg. So it's pretty brutal, but it does fulfill Deborah's prophecy that the battle would be won by a woman. Just as a little Bible trivia, Sisera was known to steal women and to turn them into sex slaves, so it's very ironic that a woman eventually killed him in quite a sexually alluring way. That's just an interesting fact for you. But as you might be able to tell from this rather disturbing story, that the book of Judges is pretty disturbing in itself. The stories found in it are violent and perverted, and they describe dysfunctional people in an incredibly dysfunctional culture. So why were things so nasty, you might be asking? Well, the time of Judges was a time of huge religious and political upheaval. It was in between the time of Joshua, when the Israelites were taking the land of Canaan after their 40 years in the desert, and the time of Israel's first kings. So there was quite a bit going on. And sadly, once Joshua dies, the Israelites begin to forget what their God is like and who he has called them to be. They begin to adopt the identity of all the nations around them and all the idolatry that goes with it. And ultimately, what they're doing is they're rejecting God as their leader. The Lord, therefore, in an act of painful resignation, allows the oppression of Israel by its different enemies to occur. But because the Lord still loves Israel very much, he shows his love to the Israelites within this context by raising up different people to act as sort of saviors for the nation, despite their rejection. And these people are the judges of which Deborah is one. But we see this repeated cycle throughout the book of Judges, which goes like this. Israel rebels against God. There's oppression by enemies because of it. The Israelites cry out to God for help. Salvation comes through the chosen judge, followed by a period of peace. But when the judge dies, the Israelites are soon to forget and start rebelling again. And so the cycle is continued on and on and on. So Deborah is one of these judges, and she's undoubtedly one of the better judges depicted. And as I got involved in looking at the story, I realized that there's far too much to it to fit into a 25-minute max talk. So I want to hone in on the things that I felt like God was speaking to me and to us as a congregation. So what do we notice about Deborah? Looking at her, she is obviously a very talented person. She's described as a prophet, a judge, a leader. She's a poet. She's a wife and a mother. And she has a discerning mind and a strong authority. However, through all of this, there is something else about Deborah that is far more attractive than all of her natural abilities. Deborah seems to have an unwavering trust in the Lord that underpins everything she does. And I'd therefore like to suggest that we can look to Deborah as a model of what it means to be truly confident. So before I came to London from New Zealand 5 years ago, I lived in Vancouver, Canada for a period of 7 months, over which time was the Vancouver Winter Olympics, which you might remember from the year 2010. But knowing barely anyone in Vancouver when I arrived and hardly having a scrap of cash to my name, I followed some new friends down within the first week to sign up to work for the Olympic Games. Next thing I knew, I was becoming a security guard for the Olympic Village. That's exactly the right reaction now. Because by looking at me, you're probably guessing I'm not exactly the scary bouncer material. I don't think I do too well outside some of London's clubs, but there you go. And those who know me find this fact about my life utterly hilarious, and there have been plenty of jokes made about how if the Canadian officials were hiring me, they must not be too concerned about their national security. So despite it actually turning out to be quite a fun job, I did have a moment of sheer panic before my first shift. And I said to God, why am I doing this? I am going to be so terrible at this job. But what I heard God say back to me was, Rose, I didn't ask if you were going to be good at the job. I asked if you were willing. And that's been a refrain I've held on to ever since. In Deborah's life, the odds were even more against her than mine in the Olympic Village. As you go through the book, you'll notice that most of the judges are extremely unlikely characters to have any influence within their context. For example, the judge before Deborah was a guy called Ehud, who was known as the left-handed warrior. Many commentators would say that the reason he was known as the left-handed warrior was because he was actually disabled in his right arm. And in a culture that greatly valued the ability to wield a weapon and to fight, this would have been a severe disadvantage. Deborah, of course, has a very obvious quality which makes her unexpected, and that is her gender. As you might guess, there's a lot written about the sexual politics of this fact from the biblical context, but I'm not going to hone in on that today, but it's definitely worth looking at if you fancy it. But because Deborah's gender is integral to the story, it's very important that we understand what she was up against simply because she was born female. Number one, the Jewish society that she lived in was heavily patriarchal, and number two, the way that the Canaanites treated women was also pretty atrocious. As mentioned before, from the description in Judges 5, we learn that Sisera and his army were known for sexually assaulting and enslaving women. Yet despite the heavy inequality, Deborah acts as a hugely successful agent for the Lord. Might I suggest that her confidence has less to do with her natural talent, although this is significant, and more to do with knowing the God that gave it to her. If we look at verses 4 and 5 of the text, we'll notice that Deborah is living a life based on the presence of God, a radically different choice from everybody else in her country. And we know this because, unlike many of the other judges in the book, she is never described as being met by God and raised up for a specific time, for example, like the judge Gideon who comes after her. We can assume that she'd already made a habit of dwelling with the Spirit of God. And it was because of this that she was able to grasp her true self and be put in a place where she could be an influential leader. So the concept of knowing your true self and its relationship to self-confidence has been popularized in modern psychology. And since I'm a current counseling student, I thought I'd throw in a concept from psychoanalysis. Donald Winnicott was a psychoanalyst in the 1960s, and he looked at the effects of childhood on adult behavior. He had a concept of the true self, which in very basic terms is the ability to live with integrity within your own psyche. He argued that the true self is enabled because of the love that you receive from your parents as a child. On the other hand, the false self is made from defensive behavior put in place to protect your true self from pain. And Winnicott argues that, again, the false self is formed in childhood, and it forms particularly when a child doesn't receive the love that they need and they are left to emotionally fend for themselves. And what it results in is neglecting or sometimes being completely unaware of the person that you really are. So as I find with many psychological concepts, this only describes what God has already spoken about human nature. The parent-child relationship is one of the most potent forces in our lives, which, as we know, can result in a lot of pain for people. But fortunately, as strong as the familial ties are, our tie to God as the ultimate parent is even stronger. And what this means is that we will never find our true selves without knowing our place as his child and receiving love from him. For those of you who've been in church for a while, this isn't going to be a new idea for you. However, ask yourself, is being a beloved child of God something that you've fully grasped? Have you let this inform your view of yourself and how you live your life? So last week, I was having a bit of a wobbly week as I was writing this talk, which is quite funny. I was doubting myself, and as per usual, I blew that totally out of proportion and began doubting my ability to do anything in life, which historically hasn't been a super uncommon thing for me. So as this talk was coming together, I had to give myself a little sermon on confidence, which is where a lot of this came from. And the conclusion that I came to was, I can be confident because God has confidence in me. So my workmate Angela, who's an amazing psychotherapist in training, sorry, there's so much psychology in here, but once told me that a lack of confidence has its roots in a shame-based mentality. Which is interesting because one of the root meanings for the word confidence in ancient Hebrew, which we find in the Old Testament, is a word called batak, which can be translated as to be open or to be exposed but still feel safe. Yet we so often feel exposed and utterly unsafe. What is that all about? I think one of the greatest threats to our confidence is shame, and it's a problem as old as Adam and Eve. There's a psychologist, again, called Gershon Kaufman, who says this about shame. To feel shame is to feel seen in a painfully diminished sense. The self feels exposed both to itself and to anyone present. To live with shame is to experience the very essence of the self as wanting. So a shame-based mentality says, at its essence, I am not good enough. Let's think back to the story and the response of Barak when Deborah calls him into battle. He says to Deborah, if you go with me, I will go, but if you don't go with me, I won't go. Certainly I will go with you, said Deborah, but because of the course you're taking, the honour will not be yours, for the Lord will deliver Sisera into the hands of a woman. Could it be that Barak was operating from a shame-based mentality? If we contrast Deborah and Barak, there is a huge difference, even though they were both faithful to the call, because Barak reacts in fear. And we do need to cut Barak from some slack, because the Canaanite army had 900 iron chariots, which was like dramatically technologically advanced compared to the Israelites. So it would have been like modern nuclear weapons or drones or something, fighting against like World War I guns or something like that. So it's understandable that Barak would have been a bit nervous. However, what is highlighted in the story is the difference between Deborah and Barak's responses. So while it's unfair to completely paint Barak with a tainted brush, his initial response is one of lack of confidence in God. So shame is a huge epidemic in our lives, and at the bottom of many of our emotional difficulties. As well as a lack of confidence, it also lurks behind pride and narcissism. And one of the problems with shame is that shame is ashamed of shame. So if you're anything like me, you'll be constantly trying to get off the pendulum swing between pride and despair. And for me, this is a problem perpetuated because I don't spend enough time dwelling on what God, my Father, says to me, which is, you are enough. When sin entered the world via Adam and Eve, guilt was what objectively happened to them, but shame was what they experienced. They became painfully aware of themselves and their faults, and because of this, they lost their sense of belonging to God. Fortunately for us, restoration for shame has been revealed in the cross, and we can take that. Because of Jesus, we have been unconditionally accepted as children of God and completely loved just as we are. But as much as we can talk about these concepts, this is something that needs to be experienced. And because shame by nature wants to hide, we need to bring it into the light. So I want you to ask yourself, where are you suffering from shame? And if you're up for it, ask God to show you where you're suffering from shame, because you might be quite surprised what he shows you. The bottom line is, this is going to be a lifelong battle, but you can bring your shame to God because he already knows everything about you anyway, and then ask him to show you how he feels about you. So before we wrap up and have some prayer, there's another compelling element to Deborah's character that I just want to highlight, and one that flows out of the fact that she has true confidence in God, and that is her ability to share the glory. So as mentioned, idolatry features strongly in the book of Judges. It's a really strong theme. But what stuck out to me as the ultimate idolatry present in the book when I read it through was actually the worship of self, which isn't so dissimilar to how we live today. If you read through Judges, there's a constant refrain which is written into the book, and it's this. Everyone did what seemed right in his own eyes. In other words, every person believed that the world revolved around them. So you can expect in a culture where everyone does what only seems right to them, there would also be huge amounts of selfish ambition. which doesn't so it does sound familiar to us all. Deborah, however, is different. If you've noticed already from the story, there are three people involved in the victory, and that's Deborah, Barak, and Jael. And it's Deborah who enables the collaborative effort in winning the battle against the Canaanites. In Judges 5, in the poem that Deborah wrote following the battle, she gives due acknowledgement to Barak, Jael, and most importantly, she gives all the glory back to God. So some might suggest that Deborah couldn't have gone into battle as the military leader, like some of the other judges, because at the time, her gender wouldn't have allowed it. However, I would dispute, why not? Because it sounds as though God was already using her outside of the social norms. I think rather it is because of Deborah's true confidence in her security in God that she is in a place to enable others into victory as well. So anyone who knows me relatively well knows that I am obsessed with the meaning of names. I love looking at what names mean and just dwelling on it, so and reading into it. So I might have done that to some of you, so just be careful. Interestingly, the meaning of the name Deborah is bee, as in the insect, which I think is pretty cool, and also very fitting to who she is. So to illustrate what I mean, here's a description of a beehive. The beehive is a complex system where bees perform many different tasks in order to keep the hive as a whole functioning properly. A single hive contains approximately 40 to 50,000 bees. Since bees work together for the benefit of the entire community, they are one of the most prolific examples of a working community. The word community in our English language comes from the Latin communitas, com meaning with or together, and munis meaning gifts, so essentially with gifts, which is rather nice. As a functioning community and one that works for the benefit of all, we need each other. We were created as gifts for one another. So here's a question for all of us. What would KXC look like if we were a community who were each so secure in our identity as beloved children of God that we actively sought to acknowledge the gifts in others more than we wanted to acknowledge our own? I imagine it would be pretty revolutionary, both for us and the people around us. When I was thinking through the character of Deborah, I began to think of my other workmate, Jenny. She is someone who is gifted and exudes a very godly sense of confidence. However, I've noticed that instead of focusing on her own talents, Jenny is constantly looking to affirm the gifts in other people. She actively seeks to redirect the glory off herself and onto them, not because she is insecure, but rather because she is truly secure herself, and because of that wants to see the same for others. I would encourage you to find people like my workmate Jenny and learn from them. But more than anything, I would encourage you to actively spend time listening to what God, your Father, says about you and let that change your life. So if that seems like something completely beyond what you might feel right now, that's okay. First of all, we would love to pray for you in a moment. Often it's not something that you can do in isolation. We need each other around to pray for each other as well. But secondly, ask God to show you himself. Don't strive to find it. Because he loves you so much, he will show his love to you if you let him. So if you would like to stand with me, I'm just going to ask the Holy Spirit to come.